Danny, we ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay, good evening. I just have a couple of really quick words before I introduce Rabbi Nevins, who will do the general introductions and chair the evening. My name is David Kramer. I'm director of this institution here at JTS, the library. It is our privilege to be the center of book culture here at JTS, which is now a stronger book culture now that we have brought the Beit Midrash within our walls. We sponsor book talks regularly, and it was this wonderful coming together of events. Mike Kelly's book, my invitation to him that he should come and speak, our bringing the Beit Midrash in, and these things happening at essentially the same time, which provided the occasion for this evening. It's an evening of memory and some sadness, a very poignant one in light of the recent events, but also an evening of celebration, and we look forward to hearing all about the book, but it is not I who will say more about that, but Rabbi Nevins, who, as Dean of the Rabbinical School and Religious Affairs here at the Jewish Theological Seminary, given the nature of the subject and discussion, I asked him if he would be kind enough to do this, and he agreed. So thank you, Danny.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone, and thank you to the library for hosting us this evening. I'm really just going to say a very quick word of introduction from Mike Kelly. When we decided, as you know, as we've now done, to rededicate the Beit Midrash upstairs, we said to the families, we'll find a date in the fall, right? And it was on my to-do list over the summer, but I wasn't sure when we would do it. And then when I heard that Mike Kelly had just written this book and was available to give a book talk, I said, well, that's perfect. We'll be able to do the two events together. And then when I read your book, Mike, I was just so moved. I unfortunately left JTS in 1994, just before Matt and Sarah came, although we said perhaps I met Sarah maybe in the Minyan. I'm not positive of that. But I will say that having read this book now, which I encourage you all to purchase and to read, I feel like their lives really came before me in a new way. You may ask, why are we not selling books here tonight? Well, I think that would have been very convenient and we would have sold a lot of books. It's because Mike Kelly is a very modest person, and he felt that this evening is an evening of memory. It's not an evening of commerce, and so he did not feel comfortable selling the books here. That said, they are available on Amazon, and it really is a worthy read. And one more word before I introduce Mike. Melissa Friedman, there's in the back here. Melissa's the head of our alumni affairs event, our alumni affairs here. And the Office of Alumni Affairs is sponsoring a dessert reception outside. So at the end of our program, we'll be able to continue the conversation over dessert. So I want to thank Melissa for that. Okay, without further ado, I introduce Mike Kelly. Mike, as you know, is a journalist, a writer for the Bergen Record, an author of several books, and an astonishingly good storyteller, a person who, as I read this book, I was just stunned by how much research went into it, how many hundreds of interviews, and how diverse the interviews were, from interviews with the family, interviews with friends, interviews with prosecutors, interviews with terrorists. I'm in awe of your tenacity, but also the bravery that went into that, and also the great skill that you used to share this story. So I want to welcome Mike Kelly, and he's going to speak to us, and then we'll open it up. I have a question or two, and then we'll have an open Q&A. Mike Kelly.
Thank you so much, Dan. That was a really kind introduction, and what a beautiful ceremony. Thank you so much, Shai, for speaking. David, David Hoffman still here? Thank you so much for your words. It was just wonderful. Bill Lebo, wonderful, just beautiful. I feel so privileged to be part of this. You know, as I stand here, as I was walking in today through the front door, I thought back 20 years to the fall of 1994. Sarah Duker was a senior at Barnard College right up the street. And Matthew Eisenfeld was just beginning his rabbinical studies here. They had already met in Israel, and they were already dating, but they really met here. So this place is sacred ground for a whole lot of reasons, and in particular because of Matt and Sarah. And we were having dinner downstairs earlier with Arlene Duker and the Eisenfelds and others, and many people who were speaking in the room said they could feel the presence of Matt and Sarah, and I hope you would all agree with me that I can feel that presence too. It's a very special time to be here. It's especially significant for me this evening too. My family's here, my wife is here, one of our daughters is here, and as I said earlier, Sarah's mother's here, Arlene, and her husband Bill. Sarah's sisters are here, Matt's sister is here, and Vicki and Len Eisenfeld are here, along with several other relatives from their family, so it's very significant for me. Also, some people who were extraordinarily helpful to me in researching this book. I've already mentioned Bill Lebo, David Hoffman, Edward Bernstein, Ed Bernstein, Rabbi Bernstein, Shai Held, who you've heard speak already, and Avinom Sharon. Avinom, could you... There you are. Avinom, Lieutenant Colonel Sharon was the Israeli Army prosecutor who prosecuted Hassan Salameh in his trial, and now he is now studying Talmud here in the place where Matt and Sarah were. So I've just given away the end of the book, so I'm sorry about that. We're going to do a second edition after what Shai disclosed in the ceremony. This setting here at Jewish Theological, there were several scenes in the book that I thought really were emblematic of the story. This is the place where Matt and Sarah, I believe, nurtured their love for each other, where they worshiped, where they prayed. Sarah actually led a small egalitarian prayer group or participated in it. When she was a student at Barnard, she would come here to do that. Matt, of course, participated in all kinds of worship services here. This is where they explored their faith journeys. And my book is not about faith, but the presence of faith is there on almost every page, I believe. And as a researcher, I was drawn to their faith journeys time and time and time again. And I'll talk more about that in a second. This place, this seminary, I believe, really symbolized so much of what Matt and Sarah are about. Here I am talking about them in the present tense, and you'll see why in a second. This place is dedicated to a rigorous study of Judaism, and weren't they dedicated to that? This place is intellectually rigorous, and weren't Matt and Sarah intellectually rigorous, right? This was a place that was welcoming to them and to others, an environment with a social conscience. And didn't Matt and Sarah have a social conscience, as we heard, as a number of people spoke about the story of Anne, the homeless woman who sold bookmarks out on the street. I'm going to talk more about all of this in a minute, but first I just want to take a moment and describe why I wrote this book. Lots of people ask me, particularly colleagues in my field, they say, Mike, what does it take to write a book? And I often tell them that you need to really fall in love. It can't be a brief relationship. It's got to be a long-term relationship. And if you're not in love, it's going to break down. And I have to tell you, I fell in love with this story. I really fell in love. It's significant, as Danny said, that we are gathered here tonight, only a couple of days after such horrific murders in Jerusalem. And I think that's probably on the minds of many of us. And I'm glad it is, because I think we need to remember not only what has happened in the past, of years ago, but I think what has happened in just the recent past, and how some of the evil that was brought into the lives of Matt and Sarah still is perpetuating today in the Middle East. The seeds of this book were planted in a time of immense evil. It was really on the morning of 9/11 that the seeds for this book, for me, were planted. I didn't know it at the time, but I came to learn that. On the morning of 9/11, I made my way to the waterfront in Jersey City, and I jumped on a tugboat, and I crossed the Hudson River and walked into Ground Zero about an hour or so after the towers fell. And I didn't come home for 3 days. It was a story that I felt I needed to follow. But what a story. What a confusing and mysterious story. I followed the story back to the Middle East. I had been there on a number of occasions on reporting trips. I went back to the Middle East. I went to Guantanamo Bay. I went to Southeast Asia. I covered the 9/11 Commission hearings. I covered the subsequent congressional action to reform our nation's intelligence services. And after all of that, I felt that I still hadn't barely scratched the surface of this phenomenon that we call terrorism. I ended up going back to Israel in 2006. It was a moment, and it's almost laughable now to think of this, that we believed peace was at hand, but my newspaper sent me back there to write a series of pieces about what life would be like when peace finally came to the Middle East, and how wrong I was, of course. But in exploring a number of themes, I wanted to address the theme of terrorism, and it was at that point I decided to take a look. It had been 10 years since Matt and Sarah had been killed, and I wanted to take a look back at that bombing. And I discovered, I always thought that suicide bombings were the work of one deranged person. No, they're not. They're highly sophisticated operations with lots of money and lots of technology, and a number of somewhere between 6 and 8 people actively involved and others in a supporting cast. And I found out that the Israelis had actually arrested the ringleader, the bomb maker, Hassan Salameh. So I called them up and I said, I would like to interview this guy. And I did. It was a deeply transformative moment for me. Again, I didn't realize how transformative until I thought about it. Salameh, just to be blunt about it, was a stone-cold killer. I've interviewed my share of criminals, and over time, many of them will start to soften, show remorse, offer some sense of regret. And what stunned me about this interview is that this guy didn't budge off the rhetoric at all. And he said something that I will never forget, because I tried to get personal with him, and I asked him about Sarah and Matt. And he said, they just got in the way. He didn't mean to kill him, but they just got in the way, as if they were roadkill or something to be run over. I wrote the story for my newspaper, and like so many people in my profession, I moved on to other things, but this stayed with me. And it was a couple of years later, I had been to Iraq on assignment to cover the war. I was back. I was talking with the editor of my first book, a wonderful man named Samuel Vaughn, who began his career by editing this unknown writer by the name of Dwight Eisenhower. I'm sure some of you heard of him. Sam was a legend in the publishing industry. He was in semi-retirement when I got to know him. And we used to meet at a Starbucks in Englewood, New Jersey, and talk about writing morning after morning after morning after morning. It was like taking a graduate course in writing. I hadn't seen Sam in a number of years, and he called me up. He said, let's go to lunch. He said, what's going on with you? You haven't written a book in a while. And I said, Sam, I really want to write about terrorism, but I just don't know where to dive in. And then I told him about Salameh and the interview and the intransigence of this man. And I'll never forget this. Sam pointed at my heart and he said, "You have to follow this. You have to follow this." And so I did. The research for this book, it was pretty broad-based. It involved research on the ground in Jerusalem, the West Bank, Gaza, what I call police reporting. I walked the crime scene with the police who investigated it. I returned to the crime scene with some of the ambulance drivers who were there, who attempted to rescue people. I talked to members of the Shin Bet counterterrorism agency. I talked to other members of the Israeli military, people in the judiciary, people in the government. And then I came back to the United States, and I talked to people in Washington at the White House, the Treasury Department, the FBI, the Justice Department, the federal courts, the State Department, and Congress. And then I spent time with the families, Matt's family and Sarah's family. And that's what I want to return to tonight. This book, as I said, the research in this is wide-ranging, but in the end, it's really about two people. Two young lovers who met here in this place and nurtured their love. I came to realize that so much of their lives and so much of what was lost really embodies what we lose to terrorism. Innocent people so filled with life and love and hope, cut down by a killer who said, "They just got in the way." As my research deepened on all of these topics, and these included three trials, one trial in Israel, two trials here in the United States. And by the way, one of the biggest challenges was finding the transcripts to, I think I told you the story, Arlene, the National Archives, the people who keep track of the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution, they misplaced the transcripts. It took me months to find them. But they did find them, next to the Declaration of Independence. No. As I continued to research, I was continually drawn back to Matt and Sarah. And I remember going, I don't know if you guys remember this, when I came to you and I said, "This is not a biography about Matt and Sarah, but I need to know more. I just need to know more." And so the families generously shared with me so much, not only in person, but shared with me letters and diaries and writings and all kinds of things that helped me to understand Matt and Sarah. Photographs. I'm a big believer in the power of image as a researcher. I love photographs. They tell me so much about people, not just what they're wearing and what their expressions are, but it's just a way of kind of seeing into their personalities and souls. And so I love pictures. I kept a picture of Matt and Sarah on my desk as I researched and wrote this book. Why? Because I wanted to be reminded every morning when I woke up and I walked and sat down at my desk that they were at the center of this book. After a while, I started to have conversations with them. You know, "Would you make this a little easier, please? Could you make this a little quicker? I've missed 4 or 5 deadlines already." They just said, "Keep working." So. The more I interviewed friends and family of Matt and Sarah, and I think I interviewed close to 60 friends of Matt and Sarah. I tracked down one guy in China, just a beautiful guy. We got on the phone, and he couldn't stop talking about Matt and Sarah, as if they were still part of his life. Now, think for a moment what is going on here. I'm researching this book 17 years after they died, and yet I noticed something in particular about so many friends, and we heard it tonight in the voices of Shai and David and Bill Lebo. For many people who knew them all those years ago, their lives and their personalities are still very present today. Very present today. And dare I say, as we were having dinner downstairs, a number of us got up to kind of talk a little bit about why we were here and to reflect a little bit. And a number of people said they could feel their presence in this room. And I think there's some truth to that. I could feel their presence over in the Beit Midrash. I really could. We could feel their character, their soulfulness, their goodness, their vitality, their generosity, as Shai mentioned. It still resonates today with so many friends. You know, and I'm sure some of you can relate to this, when people die, we try to remember them, don't we? And we pledge that, oh yes, we're going to remember grandpa or some uncle or whatever. And it's not easy. Over time, those memories fade. But not with Matt and Sarah. Those memories haven't faded. They're, I would say, as vibrant today as they were 20 years ago. There are many stories I could tell. The story of Annie, Anne, has been repeated a number of times, and at the risk of just boring you, let me repeat it one more time. Anne was a homeless woman. Now, how many of us have even talked to a homeless person while passing by, let alone, as Matt did, invited her up to the apartment for a cup of tea on a very cold day? Or Sarah, who used to bring food, she'd take it from the Barnard cafeteria and bring it to not only Anne, but other homeless people on the street. How many of us have done that? I haven't done it. And I think that story, in and of itself, I think just shows how rare Matt and Sarah were. What about Matt and Sarah causes us to be drawn back to them? What is it about them? I think I know. And I just want to throw this out to you. Matt and Sarah loved life. They loved it. To the point, as Shai was saying, they would get so passionate that sometimes they were maybe hard to be around. They loved life. They were curious about life and why it changed in front of them. They were curious and excited about what they might see or encounter on any given day with their friends, their family, their classes that they were attending, the books they were reading. I get the feeling they were really a lot of fun to be around because you were never short on a conversation. They loved their faith. They loved Judaism. Now, I'm not Jewish, but Arlene was joking with me, maybe you will be by the end of this. I came to learn so much about Judaism through Matt and Sarah. And just reading what they wrote, in buying the books that they would buy and read. They wrote a lot. I read their term papers. Sarah's term paper, her senior thesis, is just brilliant. They loved their God. They wanted to find out more about God. And don't we all? Don't we all want to figure that out a little bit? They wanted to study God as much as they could. Sarah wanted to be a research scientist, but yet she made time every day to study a little bit about Judaism. And Matt, of course, dove in hook, line, and sinker. And as I think it was David was mentioning, when you read the goals, he wanted to complete his work on that Talmud tractate, and he did it. He did it. And the photograph of which I think is in the memorial book that Ed put together. Is it in there, Ed? Yeah. Okay. I urge you to look at that. The photograph of Matt sort of leading a conversation in the apartment with all the wine bottles in the back. And talking about what he had just done. Keep in mind that they were very, very young, and yet they somehow had embarked or figured it out that they wanted to embark on this journey. I so admire that. As the sign the plaque in the Beit Midrash said, study leads to action. I'm paraphrasing, so forgive me. Study leads to action, and weren't their lives active? And aren't we all a little bit envious of that? I think sometimes, I know I was. They loved people around them. They loved having friends. They loved having parties. They loved having a good time. They studied hard. They also knew how to play hard and have a good time, and they loved all that. They loved their families. They loved their friends. They loved their colleagues. They loved each other. So many friends said to me how in love Matt and Sarah were. You know, there's a lot of talk about, would they have gotten married? What was the situation there? What were the plans? Does it really matter? These two were in love. And isn't it beautiful to have that memory all these years later, how in love they were? And I think, in many ways, in the lives of their friends. Now, keep in mind, we've moved on with our lives. You've moved on with your lives. And yet, so much of what Matt and Sarah found in each other in their early 20s is still present in the lives of so many people. That says something, I think, about their characters. You know, there was some talk as we were rededicating the Beit Midrash about how it's now a place of light. The old Beit Midrash down in the basement, I don't think it had any windows, right? No windows? Okay. No, at least I can't remember seeing any. This room, however, has an enormous amount of light. And isn't that appropriate for Matt and Sarah? They were people of light. They were people of light. You know, in chapter 1, I begin the chapter 1 with Sarah meeting with a women's prayer group in Jerusalem. And I won't go into why she met with this group. By the way, the group now calls itself, it has named itself after Sarah, and they still meet in Jerusalem. They were discussing whether or not it would be appropriate for women to wear prayer shawls while they were praying. And Sarah, of course, was leading the way in that and came to the meeting that night to discuss, citing all kinds of scriptural references, why she wanted to wear a prayer shawl. And one of the women that I interviewed who described that meeting talked about Sarah as glowing. There was a light around her hair. I'm just paraphrasing again. And I was really struck by that, because I don't think this was just, you know, something that this person was making up, because another person said something very, very similar, that Sarah had a certain light about her, a lightness about her. Compare that scene with something that was happening on the other side of Jerusalem that very night, that very time. On the other side of Jerusalem, another young person was meeting. He was a 19-year-old Palestinian man. He was recruited to be a suicide bomber, preparing himself, from what we know from interviews that the police had done with those who were with him, preparing himself to kill himself and others by praying and reading the Quran. Of course, that journey that young man was on was not toward light, it was toward darkness. The evil and darkness of murder and terrorism. At the end of the book, I describe how I tracked down the family of this suicide bomber. I wanted to interview them because I wanted to get a sense of how did they feel about what their son had done. And so on a Sunday, I drove out we went out to the West Bank. And I tracked down the family, and I talked to the father. And it was a lengthy interview, and I won't bore you with all that was said there. But toward the end of the interview, I said to him, how do people in your community now talk about your son? How do people in your community remember your son? And he said something that I don't think any father would ever want to say about his son. Keep in mind, he had already said to me, I wish I knew my son was going to do this. I would have tried to stop him. I don't approve of this. This is horrible. But then he said to me, when I said, how do people talk about your son? He said, they don't talk very much about him. Things like that go into oblivion. Things like that go into oblivion. Nobody talks about this young man anymore. But look how many people are here to talk about Matt and Sarah. Look how many people continue to talk about Matt and Sarah. If you have time, dial up the Facebook page, Friends of Matt and Sarah. You'll be there for hours. Just reading some of the sentiments that people write. Matt and Sarah have not faded into oblivion. They are very much still with us. The light in their lives still shines. I want to say something about Arlene and Lenny and Vicky and the other members of the Duker and Eisenfeld families. You all kept that light alive when you courageously stood up and said, we need to pursue some justice here. We need to walk this path. And let me tell you something. Our government did not offer a lot of help here. These families walked this journey by themselves, and it was not easy. It was not. And I thank you for that, because that courage set a precedent, and now, just last 2 weeks ago, families of U.S. soldiers filed a major lawsuit against banks that have been funneling money to terrorist groups. Families of U.S. soldiers who were killed in Iraq. So what you guys did has now impacted people's present lives. And I thank you for that, and our country should thank you for that. I know I've said this to you before, but I want to say it again. You shined light into the darkness. And in a way, all of us coming here tonight, I think, we're shining a little bit of light into that darkness. When we shine light into the darkness, I think we are at our best. Shining light into the darkness is doing God's work. As Shai was talking about, you know, created in the image of God, this is when I think we become closest to that image, when we are able to shine some light into some darkness somewhere. Matt and Sarah did that every day. They seem to do it, I think, every day somehow. And that is why we remember them tonight, and that is why we will remember them always. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I want to ask you one or two questions, and then we'll open it up for everybody else. You spoke tonight about how you fell in love with the story, and I can say that you also fell in love with the subjects of your story and became a friend to the families. And you also speak quite a bit about Alyssa Flatto and her story, and clearly were very taken by that. And yet, you sought out this killer, this Hassan Salameh, the bomber.
Right.
And as you said tonight, you were exploring to see, was there any regret, any remorse? And he was almost robotic in saying, you know, they just got in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm curious, how did you respond when he said that, and you kept probing him for that human response, that empathy, and he wasn't showing it? Can you share with us what you felt inside and perhaps what you
sure,
said to him?
Sure, sure. I did something that I rarely do in an interview. I really tried to shake him up. I deliberately physically moved close to him, almost knee to knee. We were sitting on metal chairs. I wanted to get into his space, and I wanted to kind of shake him up a little bit. So I tried to challenge him on a whole lot of levels. I questioned him. I said, "You call yourself a soldier?" "Yes, I'm a soldier." "Well, what kind of soldier kills innocent, unarmed people? In my book, that's a war crime." I said, "If you're so brave, how come you didn't, you know, volunteer to be the suicide bomber?" I tried to challenge him as a coward, all kinds of different levels. And I have to tell, the photographer was with me. He said, "Mike, I've never seen you like this." And I did this deliberately. I wanted to really, really get in his face. And I have to tell you, I did not lay a glove on this guy. As I said earlier, he's a stone cold killer. Have you noticed his? He didn't lay a glove on him either, right?
We've got the same interview that the General Security Service has got for him. There's no getting his face.
I think you're right. I've come to believe that this is. I think he almost took a. I don't think he really believed that what he was doing was God's work, even though he tried to convince me it was. I think he was nothing more than a thug. I go into this in the book. His first job as a Hamas member was an enforcer. He was essentially a mobster. And he would attack alleged collaborators, some of whom, by the way, were women. I think this guy was a bully, and I think he enjoyed being a bully. And I'm glad, thanks to Avi Noam, that he's in jail for 46 consecutive life sentences. By the way, there's a legal precedent there that Avi Noam was able to set as the prosecutor. There was some talk about just prosecuting Salome for three murders, the three bus bombings he was involved with, which would have been three life sentences. And Avi Noam was able to convince the court to make it 46 separate murders. And in doing so, he personalized these cases. And this is something I want to come back to. Terrorism is personal. In my business, we're constantly covering acts of terror as body counts. X number of people were killed in this bombing, and then we quickly get into the political context and stuff like that. When it really comes down to the basics, terrorism is murder, and it's personal in the lives of families who have lost people. And I think the more we can remember that as a country, I think the better we will be. So there's a long answer to a very good question.
One more question, then we'll open it, which is a good amount of the book is about the lawsuits the families pursued here in the United States victoriously, but then the much more difficult process of trying to collect punitive damages, which were designed to be a deterrent,
right,
to convince Iran and other state sponsors of terror that it was not worth it to them and that they would have a serious price to pay. Do you think that was successful? Do you feel, you know, based on the follow-up of the subsequent years, that Iran and maybe other countries have thought twice about the wisdom of this process of supporting terrorists?
I don't think so. I don't think the Iranians have changed one iota. And despite the fact that our government is trying to negotiate with them, I don't think the Iranians have given up on sponsoring terrorism. And that's a sad fact of life. The judge in this case was, I believe, a brilliant man. The American judge, Judge Royce Lamberth, a very interesting man, appointed by President Reagan, was a fairly conservative constitutional scholar. I interviewed him at length, and if you get a chance, go and read his opinions. They're they're very reflective on what this was all about. He was concerned. I remember he mentioned to me, Judge Lamberth was the presiding judge in the trial of the Marines that were killed in Beirut. Over 220 Marines were killed in Beirut. A number of, I think, 18 sailors and three Army soldiers. It was roughly 250 U.S. service personnel were killed by Hezbollah in Beirut, Lebanon. Judge Lamberth awarded them a judgment of $2.8 billion against the government of Iran. They haven't collected it yet. They're trying. But Judge Lamberth said to me, he said, it's really a drop in the bucket of Iran's revenues. And so I think, yes, I think these lawsuits were vitally important because it was important for the United States court system to recognize that American citizens needed to have some sense of justice when their loved ones are killed. The White House didn't want any part of this. The U.S. Justice Department didn't want to jump in. The FBI said they were going to investigate, but as I show in my research, the FBI did very little. And in the end, they had a chance to extradite Salome, bring him back to the United States, put him on trial, and they decided not to. I think they had a lock-solid case. The guy confessed. But they decided not to do this. So it took the United States Congress to pass a law allowing American citizens to follow up on their own. But it, as you all know, it took enormous amounts of energy, enormous amount of time, and it was not easy. It was not easy. Extraordinarily difficult. And I just think the lack of support from our government is sad, because that lack of support continues to this day. We don't have a standard policy of how we handle terrorist attacks when American citizens are killed overseas. Yeah, sometimes we send in the military. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the Justice Department, the FBI get involved, or the CIA. But most often, it's ordinary citizens being left to their own. And if you look at the lawsuit in Brooklyn 2 months ago from American families that sued the Arab bank, they went on, they did that on their own. They didn't have any help from our government in doing this. So this is something that I think needs to be rectified. Okay, anyway, if anybody has a question, ask me anything you'd like. Who's going to be first? Eddie, yes.
Yeah, Mike, thanks again for your reporting, your passion, your friendship. It's just a tremendous work.
Thank you. You were Ed was an enormous help to me. Ed supplied a number of the videos that I looked at. It was important to me to look at contemporaneous videos, particularly from Israel, and I thank you for that. Yeah.
Hassan Salame is still in prison. I remember when Gilad Shalit was
right.
Was released. There was a very painful prisoner exchange, and a number of very unsavory characters were let loose. Some of them have been rounded up again since then. But
right.
Has there been any concern that Salome would ever make it onto such a list in an exchange for an Israeli prisoner of war?
Hamas has asked that he be turned loose. His name's been scratched off the list almost from the get-go by the Israelis, and I think that's a good move. Salome, I feel, is one of a number of maybe five prisoners who will probably never get released. These include Marwan Barghouti, the other Barghouti whose name, first name escapes me, and there's two others, and then there's Salome. All of these guys are guilty of mass murder, and attempts by the Palestinians or Hamas to try to get some kind of freedom from them have fallen flat. But you know, that was one of the debates that was that took place within the context of the trial that Avinoam prosecuted. One of the judges opted for the death penalty. The two other judges in the trial overruled him. The concern being that if Salome is alive, that perhaps one day he would get released. Personally, realistically speaking, having talked to a number of Israeli officials about this, I think the chances of him getting released are pretty much nil. And I don't see that happening for a very, very long time. And particularly in light of what's going on over there, the cycle of violence is just continuing in a way that's enormously tragic. And I think if that continues, I just can't see this happening. So that's just a guess, but that's that. I think it's a pretty solid guess on my part. Hope so. Somebody else? Oh, yes, Arlene.
I've read most of the book. I already told you I've been, dipping in.
I know.
The parts, a lot of stuff we never knew because you were able to get all the information about what was going on, the backstories of everything. But given what happened in Israel 2 days ago and the murder of 5 people in that synagogue,
right.
I was really struck by how it feels like, okay, they're buried, and the story is there, but it's a small story. 4 more victims of terrorism in Israel, Arabs, Palestinians celebrating in Gaza, quiet among the nations of the world. Okay, the President of the United States made a statement. Not much is happening there. It's almost as though, well, there's terrorism, yes, and that's really terrible, and now what else are we going to do? And I don't know if you found anything in your research, any way that somehow or other this could actually be on the front burner, that it's important enough for the nations of the world and people in general to do something so that it's not accepted or on the back pages within 3 days and, oh, 4 more people killed.
Right.
Shame. That somehow or other was our purpose in wanting to go to court and wanting to do all these things to make some impact. And I'm just wondering if you found anything that would move that along.
Unfortunately not. The scenario that you just described, Arlene, is unfortunately very true. I believe that one of the aspects of my research, I spent months trying to understand the theology of suicide bombing. I was a lot of fun to live with during that time period, I got to tell you. And the more I looked at it, the more I studied it, the more I came to the conclusion that there is a serious, serious theological problem within Islam. Not only over this notion of martyrdom, which completely turns the traditional view of martyrdom of within Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, all the world's major religions, turns it right on its head, this notion that you can kill yourself and kill others and be a martyr. That's number one. Number two, this notion that you can kill other innocent people and that that's God's will. That's not God's will. I think by any reasonable definition, that's not God's will. But there is a segment of Islam that buys into that theology. Now, the President of the United States spoke at the United Nations in October and talked about how he would like to see the Muslim world talk more about these kinds of issues. And the voices in the Muslim world, I mean, think when somebody does something, whether it's in Judaism or Christianity, when somebody does something out of line, calls it an act of God and murders somebody or whatever, immediately scholars from Judaism and Christianity and other religions are condemning that act. There's no shortage of condemnation. I'm talking about like when these Christian fundamentalists would shoot up an abortion clinic and that sort of thing. The killings by Rabbi Dr. Baruch Goldstein several years ago, immediately condemned. Tuesday's murders were not condemned. How can anybody, and if you look at the Quran, it's not this kind of stuff is hard to justify. And so I believe that if change is to come, the change you're talking about, it's really got to come within the Muslim world. And I don't see that happening. The voices are really faint. The one voice here in the United States, and I've been enormously critical of him as a columnist, the one voice who spoke up was the guy who was the cleric who was behind the so-called mosque at Ground Zero. He's like the only guy who's spoken up about this on national TV, Imam Faisal Rauf. The other voices are few and far between, and when they do speak, they're very, very faint. That's unfortunately the reality. Sorry.
I'd just like to say it's a really painful point that we're at, and there's truth. There is something that's very wrong with a large portion of the world's Muslims that would embrace this. As it happened yesterday at JTS, we also had a luncheon where we had Muslim scholars from around the country who are here as part of a multi-year study that's been between Hartford Seminary, actually, and JTS and also ISNA. And there was condemnation of that, you know, around the tables there. Right. And what I feel like, you know, part of the danger is we go into our separate camps and fill ourselves with anger, and some of it is justified and necessary and understandable, and yet there's also got to be that other reaction of trying to build bridges so that we can also build friendship, and not a naive friendship, right? A clear-eyed friendship that allows you therefore to have a relationship in which you can speak hard truths to one another and really get that response. So maybe there'll be one more question, and then we're going to turn to the dessert reception. So
I'm actually glad to hear that you're doing that and you're getting some positives. That's really great. I'm glad to hear that. Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is probably a very bad note on which to go to the dessert. But I've been haunted since Hannah Arendt came out with the Originality of Evil.
Yes.
How much harm she's done by, in a way, trivializing evil by framing it this way.
Talking about her writings about Eichmann?
Yeah. Yes, her writings about Eichmann. His actions were not banal. I mean, he became an expert on Jews, the better to kill them.
Right.
And so on. And so I think what we need are more studies in the nature of evil. That evil, the reason it's so complicated is that it's both a personal and a collective phenomenon. And so we have to understand the conditions that make modern evil possible. And if we don't do that, this spiral is going to continue on. It's too facile. People like Hannah Arendt can make it seem like it's like an ordinary thing that can happen when a bureaucrat follows order. It's not an ordinary thing.
Right. Well, let me just say, hopefully, and if nobody has any more questions. I believe, as I said earlier in my talk, the best way to confront evil is to shine light into that darkness. And these families here did that. They shined that light into that darkness. And please don't ever believe that you only did something small, because what you did was great. You didn't solve the whole problem, but you started people to take another step and another step and another step. And that is good. That is really good. And I believe that if we don't turn off the light, then we'll be better people for it, and we need to continue doing that. And whether we do it through just speaking up or reading about it or trying to research it or whatever, we need to try to do that, I think, and not forget about it.
Thank you so very much, Mike. Thank you for your words, for your teaching. And everyone, thank you for coming this evening. And please do come to the dessert reception. And I do encourage you to get a copy of the book. It really is a very important read.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I just ask if you took a chair?
Thank you.